Arranged by Metallurgy Center for Human Sciences. My name is Asko Tolvanen, and I have pleasure to open this festival. The day is started by opening speech of rector of our university, Matti Manninen. After that, Professor Job Hawkes from the Utrecht University will give his plenary presentation. But first, Rector Matti Manninen, please.
It's my pleasure and honor to talk with so large audience. I'm happy that so many people have come to this festival for the new methods. But I first want to wish you all welcome to the University of Jyväskylä. We have a special year this year. The university is celebrating its 150 years anniversary, started 1863 as a teacher's college, and then later became a university for teacher education and eventually a multidisciplinary university in the 1960s. Already the start of this university in 1963 was quite new at that time. It was the first college teaching Finnish language teachers, or teachers teaching in Finnish language in the whole country. But the person who started it, Uno Syngnäus, was very much ahead of its time. He, for example, required that all the teachers of this college have to go abroad for a year to practice also international collaboration and so on. And you have to remember, this was the time when there was no railroad, there was no cars, there was no airplanes, but still people were traveling, and it's not any new. But today is every day. Now, when University of Jyväskylä became a multidisciplinary university, then first, of course, like at that time, all the departments and faculties were separated. At the moment, we have 7 faculties. But then some later, it was found out that it's much better if the different disciplines work together, and not only in Jyväskylä, but all over became a fashion of multidisciplinary or cross-disciplinary or interdisciplinary, whatever name you want to use, research. And we also followed to that, and we have started several units which were meant for multidisciplinary research. First we had started Agora Center, which is in this building, which mainly brings together human sciences, sports, and information technology, and works in the field of human technology very much, and also psychology. And around the same time, in the Faculty of Science, started a nanoscience center, which brought together biology, chemistry, and physics in the same building and same laboratories. And what I have learned in these experiments, that the most important thing is to bring the people close to each other together. If they are in separate buildings, 50 meters is too long distance for them to start to collaborate in daily basis. But if they are mixed in the same building, this works very much, very well. Now, for this festival, we started also some time ago a center for, like we heard of, the methods of mainly for help human sciences and the social sciences, sport and others for methods which are not in a way different than what we have in let's say in science and mathematics. My own profession is in physics, and for me, this, when I heard it first time, sounded sort of funny that why do you need the center for methods? Because in physics education, everything you teach is methods, and the same is essentially mathematics. But then I understood later that if you work in sciences with actually handle as difficult, if more difficult problem having to do with human nature or how humans behave, which is in a way more difficult problems than what one solves, or at least as difficult than what solves in physics, chemistry or mathematics, one needs to look at the methods in different way, because it's not only quantitative methods, but you also need qualitative understanding what you do, and in that way I understood that it's more, this kind of thing is needed, and this center has done a very good job bringing together PhD students and also researchers from different fields. They have started new education and so on. And I think this is the third of this festival, how many have had arranged together with other universities, and I'm happy to that we can host it in this university this year. And I hope you find some new methods, solve some challenging problems, and wish you all a very successful festival. And I hope you have some time also now when the weather is nice. Those who come from outside of the university, look at our beautiful campus in this area, and also walk to the old campus on top of the hill where you have the oldest buildings from 1892, and there are also buildings designed by the most famous Finnish architect Alvar Aalto. There's also Alvar Aalto Museum and a very beautiful city with nice entertainment in the evening. So please enjoy your stay here and have a nice festival.
Thank you, Rector, for your very supportive words. And now I have pleasure to welcome our keynote speaker, Professor Joop Hox from Utrecht University, Netherlands. Professor Hox is leading expert of the field of multilevel and structural equation modeling. I believe that almost everyone who has uses multilevel analysis has read the book Multilevel Analysis, written by Professor Hox. Welcome, Professor Joop Hox.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to this nice methods festival. I must say I have been to Finland a few times, but never to Jyväskylä, so that is something new for me. Let me say a little bit about myself. My name is Joop Hox, and I work at the Utrecht University, but I studied psychology at the University of Amsterdam. But I got sidetracked really quickly into research methods. And after I graduated, I got to work in the educational field. And there I got interested in multi-level models for the simple reason that people who work in education have multi-level problems. They have multi-level data, and they need to work with that. And at that point in time, multi-level analysis was just kind of coming about, so I got in very early. And in my dissertation, I had used structural equation modeling, and I tried to join them, but did not quite succeed. And then in 1990, I got to stay for a short while at the University of California, Los Angeles, where Beck Butane was right at that moment developing the techniques to do multi-level structural equation modeling. So I got very excited about that, and I've been working in that area since then. And I do hope that I can get you excited about it as well. The structure of my course is, my presentation is rather simple. It has three parts. And first I want to tell you a little bit about structural equation modeling. I'm not going to assume that you all know what it is. And I'm also not going to bore you with a lot of formulas, a few of them, because I think a methods festival like this should not be a course where we bore each other with extreme detail on how to do things. It is to expose each other to research methods that some of you may not really be experienced with, and to get you excited about trying out some of these things for yourself if they are appropriate for what you're doing. So I'm going to talk about structured equation modeling, about multi-level modeling, and about the idea that they are merging. And for each of these topics, I want to say something about why is this interesting? So if you have structured equation modeling, why is structured equation modeling an interesting thing to do? And is it useful, and for what is it useful? Same thing for multi-level modeling. Why is it interesting, and what is it useful for? And of course, you can imagine that the question, are they indeed merging, will be answered by me by yes. But the question again is, of course, why would this be an interesting thing? What would it be useful for? So that is the structure of my talk. And for structured equation modeling, I actually went to Wikipedia to say what they said about that. And they said that structured equation modeling is a statistical technique for testing and estimating causal relations using a combination of statistical data and qualitative causal assumptions. And I kind of disagree with that definition. It follows most of it, but the really dangerous word in there is causal, of course, because most of the time structured equation models are used on correlational data. And what happens then, of course, that you can test models, but you cannot really say much about causality unless you have very strict rules on how you collect the data and strict rules on the kind of analysis you do. So yes, it can be used for causal model, but in a limited way, and you need to know a lot about causal modeling before you actually can do it with some confidence. If you go back to the 80s, Lisrael modeling, as it was then called, had become very popular in sociology, and it was all interpreted in a causal way. So you have dozens of articles saying a causal model for this and a causal model for that, and never in the history of sociology have they proven so many causal models. And of course, all of these models kind of contradicted each other, and most of them are forgotten by now. So causality is not a word to be used lightly. The way I view structured equation modeling is mostly like conveniently a combination of factor analysis and path analysis. And I'm going to step a little bit aside now so I can look a bit more at the pictures and also at the screen. Path analysis is basically started as an analytical graphical tool. You want to specify relations between variables, but you want to specify something more complicated than a regression model or analysis of variance. You want to specify structures. And this was actually invented by a geneticist, Sewell Wright, and his first published article about this was in 1921, so he had been working on this for a couple of years, but this was the first publication. And then you look at diagrams like this. And as you can see, the reason he developed these diagrams was because he wanted to do two things. He wanted to be able to do indirect effects. So you have an exogenous variable here, that's why it's labeled XO1. It has an effect on an endogenous variable, 1, and that has an effect on an endogenous variable, 2. So you have an indirect effect, what we would now call a mediation effect. He was very interested in that type of effects and wanted to have a means of estimating these effects. And the other thing he wanted to do is make a strict distinction between those variables that are exogenous and these variables that are endogenous. And exogenous variables are in social science usually called independent variables, meaning that they are, at least in terms of this model, thought of as causes or things that have an effect in the model. And endogenous means any variable that is predicted by something else. So although this variable is predicting the second endogenous variable, it is viewed as an endogenous variable because it is being predicted by the other two variables over here. So he wanted to look at these type of structures. And by the way, of course, this is his picture. So the distinction between exogenous and endogenous is something that he found very important, and the other one was the distinction between direct and indirect effect. And furthermore, he went on later in the 20s to develop rules to actually get estimates. So he wanted to have estimates for all these paths, and he wanted to have estimates for the direct and indirect effects. And he established the rules to do that. Basically, what you would do is a lot of regression analysis and then piece these things together. And that worked provided the model is recursive. And recursive means there are no reciprocal paths. So if you would have a path that goes back from this one to that one, it's not a recursive model. And it's a model for which the rules that Wright developed cannot be used. They won't work. But if you have these recursive models, you just do a lot of ordinary least squares regression, standard regression models, you get a lot of regression equations, and you can combine them into estimates for all these paths, which is really nice. And by the way, these are error terms. Whenever you predict something, there will be an error term, which basically means I cannot predict with total accuracy, which would, of course, be the general rule. That's not what you usually can do. Another part, another root of structural equation modeling is actually older than path diagrams. It's vector analysis. And I have to count. 9 years ago, there was a conference in Virginia called 100 Years of Vector Analysis. And that relates back to this year, 1904. That is the first published article about vector analysis by Charles Spearman, who was working in intelligence, and he had a lot of intelligence tests, and there was some debate about, well, what kind of intelligence do we have? Do we have one kind of intelligence, that people are smart or dumb, or do you have people that are good at one thing and less good at another thing, meaning you have several different types of intelligence? That was a big question then. And he proposed to do an analysis, which is now called factor analysis, where you take a number of intelligence tests, assume that there is one general intelligence factor that underlies all of these tests, and estimate this factor. And his reasoning was, all of these tests measure intelligence, but they measure it with some kind of measurement error. Everything is measured with some kind of error. If you think of psychological tests, probably a lot of error. So if we seem to see correlations that are not so high between different intelligence tests, that does not mean that they are estimating different things. It means that they have measurement error. That was his reasoning. So actually he was proposing two things. He was proposing what we now call factor analysis, and he was proposing a way to deal with measurement error. In a manner, he was the first person who actually proposed a measurement model, the first psychometrician, if you would call it that. Well, very soon, a lot of people discovered that having only one factor was not enough. If you wanted to explain correlations between intelligence tests, even if you account for the idea that there is measurement error, one factor will generally, in most sets of tests, not do it. So two people have been very important, and we're talking about the 1930s, 1940s. This is Spearman. This is Cattell, and this is Thurstone. And both Cattell and Thurstone developed models for having more than one factor, for several factors. And I think you can fairly call them the founders of modern factor analysis, in the sense that we have several factors and we try to do some kind of rotation to get factors that can be interpreted really clearly. So these are the founding fathers, the foundations of structural equation modeling, because structural equation modeling kind of combines that. Next development. This is Carl Jureskog, and I would say that it is extremely difficult to overestimate the influence Carl Jureskog has had on structural equation modeling. In the time that he was writing his dissertations and some of his seminal works, his dissertation was 1963, on estimation methods in factor analysis. One thing that statisticians like is a maximum likelihood estimation, because it works very well under a very large series of circumstances, even with slightly non-normal data, etc., etc. But at that time, there were some ideas of how to do maximum likelihood factor analysis, but they were computationally not feasible. Not only because the computers tended to be small, but also because the computational procedures were not really that good. So one thing that Jureskog has done, he has done a lot of development in factor analysis, path analysis, and combining these two in structural equation models, but he was not the only doing that. There were several people working in that field. He was just very good, but there were a number of other good researchers working on that. But what his unique contribution was is to develop computational methods that actually worked, and to put them into programs that actually worked and to give these programs away. Unfortunately, they're no longer doing that. They're selling them. But he was giving them away for a long time and giving courses to people on how to work with these problems. So he was the one to first brought out programs for maximum likelihood factor analysis, for maximum likelihood factor analysis and path analysis, where you could actually work with multiple groups and constrain parameters to be the same across different groups, which are important things. And in 1973, he brought out the program LISREL. And that is the program that could, for the first time, in a really nice way, combine all of these things in one piece of software. So it could do structured equation modeling in the sense of doing path and factor analysis and lots of combinations. And many of the things that we are now still thinking of as important analysis models for instance, cross-cultural research, longitudinal research, that stuff could all be done in LISREL 1973 already. So structured equation modeling is, in a sense, quite old, and it has a long history. And this is what the LISREL model looks like. And just in case you wonder, what's this? Let me decompose it into something simpler. Statisticians working in structured equation modeling love Greek letters. So especially if you look at methodological treatises on this kind of modeling, you will see a lot of Greek letters. But the actual part is not all that difficult, because you still have the distinction between exogenous and endogenous variables, the idea of indirect effects, which Sewell White came with, and what is extra put in by combining this with factor analysis is the idea of latent variables, factors that you assume are there. It's the hypothesis that they are there, but you don't actually measure them. So these small pieces are factor analysis. So here we have the X variables, the independent or exogenous variables. But we think of them, we have a latent variable Xi, which is simply the Greek letter X. And that is a factor, it's not observed. But it has observed empirical indicators, which we call X. So here we have this path going from exogenous to endogenous. Here we have the outcome variables Y, and these are eta, which is the Greek letter for Y. So here you have the endogenous variable Y1, which is predicted here by this Xi, and in turn it predicts another dependent variable Y2. And this is again a latent variable, and we can estimate all these things because we have observed indicators for that. So this is actually the LISREL system in its simplest form. We have latent variables. That's the main thing we like to work with for the measurement error. We have factor models on how to measure these latent variables. And this is the part where we have, this is probably the part that we are interested in from a theoretical point of view, because that is the substantive hypothesis about how these constructs relate to each other. And if you go back, you will see that actually, it's this structure is still there, exogenous, endogenous. In this path diagram, everything is written in a box, which means it's an observed variable. And in the LISREL path notation, the circles mean these are latent variables. So in this complicated picture, we see the same thing, because to the left, we have a whole bunch of X's. We have three Xi variables, and they could be correlated. And they, in turn, have an effect on a bunch of eta variables, which are the dependent variables. And here we have actually a reciprocal relationship. Arrow going there, another arrow going back, means that there's no way that Sewell Wright's procedures could estimate a model like this. And of course, these are latent variables, these are factors, so you have observed variables that correspond to them. So although this looks quite complicated, it all fits completely within this scheme. And what I'm doing here is I'm using the official Greek letters. So whenever you predict something, you have a prediction error, which is called zeta, the Greek letter z. And whenever you have indicators of a latent variable, we also mean there is some measurement error. For the x's, they are called delta, Greek letter d. And for the y's, they are called epsilon, Greek letter e. So this is fixed notation, which may be unusual if this is the first time that you see it. But the nice thing is, if you, as a statistical person, talk about this type of model, we know exactly what we're talking about. If somebody says, okay, I'm talking about the error epsilon, somebody who knows this system knows exactly what this epsilon is. So that's why all these Greek letters are used. If you have an applied publication, of course, you don't use all these Greek letters. You just talk about these parts of the model that are important to you in terms of your constructs and your variables. And I will show an example of that as well. This is the entire model, and it was worked out by a number of people called Jurisco, Keesing, and Wiley. And Keesing and Wiley also did a lot of econometricians. They did a lot of developmental work on the models. Jurisco was the one who made it usable, who worked out the computational problems and who made software that actually did it. Actually, what you can do, you can chop off the entire X part and still do it. The only difference here is now you have to keep track of which variables eta and y you think are exogenous and which variables you think of as endogenous. The model will no longer distinguish them. So in this model, it's actually forbidden, it's impossible to have a correlation between delta 1 and epsilon 1 because they belong to entirely different parts of the model. If you use this part, you could, since you use only this part of the model, you could easily have correlations in place which are actually by statisticians not allowed. So this is more flexible, but in a sense also a little bit more dangerous because it allows you to put parameters in place, regression coefficients, paths, correlations, where you usually would not want them. And I should say, the programs that use this is most programs now use this part only, especially AMOS is kind of dangerous because there the input is just a path diagram. And I love it because when I teach students how to work with it, they can just learn it quite quickly. But what I hate about it is that then I have to teach them which of all these interesting paths and correlations or whatever they can draw in make sense. Because it's very easy to put in effects that do not make sense. The program does not make that difficult for you. Actually, it makes it easy for you to put that in. Some extensions. I have been talking about classical structured equation modeling. It used to be called analysis of covariance structures, meaning that what we're looking at is basically a covariance matrix. If you have multivariate normal data and you have that covariance matrix, you can throw away the raw data. The covariance matrix is all there is to know. It's all the information that's there. It's called a sufficient statistic. But model structured equation models, software can also use non-normal variables like dichotomous or ordinal variables with few categories, or skewed variables, or incomplete data where you have cases in your analysis that you have observed only partially. Think of longitudinal data with dropout. People that drop out later, you don't want them to remove them entirely from your data, which is what listwise deletion, for instance, in SPSS would do. It's not what you want to do. You want to keep them in the data for that part where they actually provide information. And that is what modern structured equation software is able to do. Even further, in the original idea, of course, you have continuous outcome variables that are being predicted by continuous, unobserved latent factors. Modern software also allows for latent factors that are categorical. That thing is called latent class analysis usually, but it is also a structured equation model. So there are lots of extensions now to the original ID, but the original ID is still there. We have exogenous, endogenous variables. We want to look at indirect paths, and we want to have latent factors in our model because that's a way to deal with the measurement error. So why is structured equation modeling interesting or useful? Well, it allows for a number of models that have very interesting substantive implications. And I have put six here on this slide. Analyzing measurement models, so analyzing them. The second one is including measurement models in a substantive model, so you are interested primarily in some substantive theory about how constructs relate to each other, but you would like to have measurement models so you can look at what the constructs relate to each other without partitioning out the measurement. People who make measurement instruments are very much interested in construct validity, and these are tools to investigate that. We have already the idea of indirect paths mediation, which is the original idea that Sewell Wright was interested in. Cross-cultural comparisons, that's actually one way how I got involved in structural equation modeling. And longitudinal data. Those are six important substantive areas where structural equation modeling has made contributions. And I'll show briefly one of each of them. Before I do that, I will take off my watch so I can watch the time. Because I have a beautiful iPad there which shows me the time, but it's in sleep mode now. Okay, well, Spearman's article actually started thinking about measurement. This is an actual quote from his article. This original article has been scanned and it's available on the internet. So one of his sentences is that he says, discrepancies must inevitably arise from errors in measuring. And then he discusses how to actually estimate what he calls true correlations, which means true correlations where the measurement effect has been taken out. We now know that as correction for attenuation, but he was the guy who developed it. And when he discussed how true correlations and true variables, which now we would probably call latent factors, how they relate to observed variables and what the effect is of thinking about true correlations, he was actually talking about what is now classical reliability theory. So that goes back a long way, the first ideas about how to think about this. And as a matter of fact, of course, structural equation modeling, which is an outgrowth of his work, can be used to estimate measurement models. So if you are interested in measurement models, you want to know what's going on, you can go do IRT modeling, which is the modern way of thinking about it, which is actually also a variety of structural equation model. And the classical reliability, which is still used a lot, can also be expressed as a structural equation model. And actually, it's not that difficult once you have, of course, the software and the idea of doing this kind of thing. So, reliability coefficient alpha. A lot of you are probably familiar with that. It's a coefficient of internal consistent. It gives you an idea of the reliability of a measurement instrument that consists of items. So let's assume that we have three items, which I will call x1, x2, and x3. And we have a latent variable, xi, the Greek letter, now written in Latin letters. Actually, the reliability coefficient alpha is a structural equation model. Actually, it's a confirmatory factor analysis model, which looks like this. We have a latent variable, which is, of course, the construct that we think, that we hope to be measuring. We have three indicators of that construct. And here we have factor loadings, and they're each labeled with a label C. And whenever you label something in a path diagram, that is usually a constraint. It means that loading for these three variables must be the same. So what you get, of course, if you do a factor analysis, what this, without this constraint, you get loadings that are slightly different, even if in the population they are the same. If you constrain them to be the same, you get something like the mean, the average of these three loadings. Actually, reliability coefficient alpha assumes, has an assumption that all the loadings in this factor analysis model are equal. I have no labels here, so it does not assume that the errors are equal, but it does assume that the loadings are equal, which is kind of restricted. And Joris Koch has written about this type of model also in the late 1970s, and he called this essential tau equivalence. Not sure how he came up with that term, but it actually means equal loadings. How do we estimate coefficient alpha in such a model? Actually, if you go back to the definition, reliability is defined as the squared correlation, the amount of shared variance, between the true score and the sum score. Can we put the sum score in a structural equation model? Actually, yes, quite easily. We simply have a latent variable. We have arrows going to that latent variable from each of these observed variables. We constrain these paths to be equal to 1, so it's an unweighted sum score. And there is no error here. We are in sense predicting, but there is no error. So this is simply the sum score. And we can, of course, calculate the correlation between those two. It's something that the program will actually output. You square that thing, and then you have coefficient alpha. Estimated in a somewhat funny way, but you can do it. And this shows that the reasoning behind coefficient alpha is actually a structured equation model, a confirmatory factor model. So, actually, if you try to run this in AMOS or M-plus or whatever, you will encounter a few difficulties because it's a bit unusual model when you predict something without an error term, but there are tricks to do it. And there's an article by Tenko Rekov who describes these tricks. There's another coefficient for reliability that most people don't know. It's called coefficient omega, and it's published mostly about by Rod McDonald. And there you have a simple difference, which is that we do not assume that these loadings are the same. They can be anything. So it's a less restrictive model than the model behind coefficient alpha. It's called a congeneric test. Who cares? But the basic idea is still we have one latent variable that underlies these three things. We have errors that are uncorrelated. There are no correlations there, but they could be different. And now the loadings can also be different. It can be tested the same way. That's the nice thing about structured equation modeling. We have the same model now. The only thing is that we have no constraints. The C's have disappeared. There are no constraints on the latent factor part of the model. And again, we can calculate the correlation between the sum score and the latent factor. The model, the software will output that somewhere. You square it, and now you have coefficient omega. And the nice thing is, let me go on immediately. Alpha can be calculated quite easily. You can find the formula in any book about measurement. It's easy. You just need to variance of the sum of the scores and the variance of the items, and there's a formula where you just plug that in and then you get alpha. Calculating coefficient omega is a bit more complex because you need those factor loadings because they are maybe different, so you need them. So you need a factor analysis to be able to calculate omega. And I think it's an advantage because it actually, we have here two models. One of them is a factor analysis with loadings being constrained to be equal. Here we have loadings that are not constrained. You can test these models against each other. So you can actually test whether the assumptions, provided you do the factor analysis, you can test the assumption whether these loadings may be assumed to be equal, in which case the coefficient that you calculate is alpha. And if they are not the same, the coefficient that you calculate is omega. And this is one of the formulas. You should not be too scared of that by now, because the lambda is the Greek letter L for loading, and this is simply the variance of the sum score. So you calculate the variance of the sum score, you do a factor analysis, and then you sum all the loadings, and you square that thing. You divide this by that, and out comes coefficient omega. So actually, you could use SPSS to calculate omega, only you have to do some hand calculation. There's a very nice free program that you can download, written by these two guys from Spain, which will actually do a factor analysis and calculate coefficient alpha, omega, and do the test whether you can assume that alpha is correct or whether omega would be better. All this just to show you that thinking about reliability is thinking about specific structural equation models. And all this became possible after, say, 1973, when Lisserl came on the market. And the advantage is we have to fit, if you fit a single factor model in a modern structured equation modeling program, or in this program factor, the program will tell you if the model fits the data. So maybe the assumption that there is a single factor underlying all your items is wrong. Coefficient alpha using reliability in SPSS will never tell that. If your actual measurement instrument is kind of a mixture of several constructs, a messy mixture, it won't tell you. It can still give you a fairly high coefficient alpha. Omega will tell you because you get it only from a factor analysis, and a byproduct of most factor analysis programs now is that it will tell you, thus the idea that there is a single factor underlying these data, does that apply? Is that a reasonable idea? So that's the advantage. The calculations behind coefficient omega might actually reject your model, might actually tell you you're not measuring anything. You may have some kind of reliability, but it's a soup of different things. Good. This is including measurement models in your model. Again, you should be able to pick out the different parts. This is the part that is substantively interesting. It's a piece of research, rather old, from the 60s. We look at alienation in 1976, and we look at alienation in 1971, and we look at social economic status in 1976, and we wonder how much of alienation in 1971 is still the effect of having a low socioeconomic status, and how much is a carryover effect from alienation in 1976. If you were alienated in 1976, you probably are still alienated in 1971. That's stability. But there might also be change. And of course, this is an indirect effect, as you should recognize. We are predicting these latent variables, so they have measurement errors, prediction errors. We try to get rid of the measurement error in the measures of alienation and social economic status. How do we do that? We have a test for anomia and a test for powerlessness. These are constructs that sociologists are quite familiar with. Together they make up alienation, but we assume there is some amount of measurement error. So alienation is not just the combination of powerlessness and anomia. It's the combination of those two where we take out the error, because this is what they have in common, and this is the unique measurement error. You find the same thing here, and you find the same thing there. So this is a way to build a measurement model into a substantive theory. We want to know the relations between alienation and alienation later and social economic status, and what we also want to take care of the measurement error. And this is how we do it. So this is measurement error, and this is what we really are interested in. This is our constructs. And talking about constructs, you have construct validity. And this is confirmatory factor analysis is one way of looking at that. We are, of course, I assume that you are familiar with the idea that if you develop an instrument that has a number of subdimensions, and this is one of them, self-concept with a number of subdimensions. I took this example from a book by Barbara Byrne. And what it says, okay, we have four subdimensions. And you could do an exploratory factor analysis in SPSS and simply tell SPSS, give me four factors. And then hopefully you find something that is more or less according to your theory. This is a bit more strict because we have these constructs here. These arrows mean that it's okay if they correlate. They're all part of self-concept, so it's okay if they correlate. Obviously, you don't want them to correlate 0.98 because it's very difficult then to argue that they are different constructs. And they're measured by specific items. So this is our hypothesis. There is no loading going from this construct to that item. And since it's not in the diagram, it's not in the model, and actually your model forbids that loading. That item simply does not belong to that subdimension, so it should have no loading. Now what you find in this type of model, if you do the analysis, you could find three things actually, but one thing is very rare. The rare thing to find is that when you do this model, you find immediately that it fits beautifully. So your hypothesis that this is how the construct validity of the self-concept measure that you have made works is confirmed. More usual, you find some exceptions. So you find a few loadings going from an item, from a factor to an item that does not belong to that factor. The thing to do then is, of course, is to look very carefully at how that item is worded and see if you can make up a reason why this item would like to load on the wrong factor too. It's called a cross-loading. Why does that happen? Maybe because the item was worded in a specific way, or because maybe it was next to an item in the questionnaire that tries to measure the other factor. So you have some kind of contamination. That's okay, you alter the model and go on. It could also be that it's completely messy, that the real model has a lot of cross-loadings, and then, of course, at some point, your conclusion must be that the way that you have operationalized self-concept, the four sub-dimensions, and the items that you have hypothesized simply don't work. Your construct is rejected, in a sense. Your operationalization of your construct doesn't work at all. So those are the two things that are most likely that you find. Sometimes you find it's a total mess and you have to abandon this measurement instrument for this construct. And hopefully you find something that with a little bit of tinkering allows you to show that you do have construct validity. And what you're doing is structural equation modeling. Another way of looking at structural equation modeling goes back to the multi-trait, multi-method matrix. The idea there is that you measure several constructs, in this terminology called traits, and you use several methods. So we have two traits here. One could be self-esteem, the other could be assertiveness or something like that. And then you have two methods to measure them. One could be self-description in a questionnaire, and the other could be observation by some observers. And you have the idea that you have these combinations of observations, and behind that we have a method factor for each of the methods. So we have a rhythm questionnaire factor, and we have an observer factor, the unique measurement properties of these things. And then, of course, hopefully you have very strongly two traits, namely the self-esteem and the assertiveness. Usually, traits may be correlated, and methods are thought of as unique. The idea of a multi-trait, multi-method matrix goes back to Campbell and Fiske, who wrote an article about it, I think, in 1956. And I don't think, but I know, that it's one of the most often quoted articles in psychology. It's been quoted literally something like 10,000 times in the 50 years since it appeared. So it's a very important article. But they only came up with the idea. They had no clear clue on how to analyze it. Their suggestion was to simply look at the correlations and make sense of that. And this is a model that has been proposed much, much later by people like Carl Juriskog and Duane Elwin, who thought, okay, structural equation modeling in the form of a confirmatory factor analysis is an ideal way to analyze a multi-trait, multi-method matrices, because you get these neat trait and method factors, and hopefully the method factors are small and the trait factors are large. That's what you hope for. Then you have a good measurement. So this is another way of looking at the construct validity of measurement instruments. Indirect paths, I came back to that. This is a typical model for mediation. So we have here we have an independent variable, and we have a dependent variable, and we have a simple regression coefficient, and the value is C. And to the right, we have the same system, but now we have a mediator. So we have still this independent variable, dependent variable, but now we have an effect going to the mediating variable and an effect from the mediating variable going to the dependent variable. The mediation effect is very simple to calculate. It's simply A times B. So that's nice. What we would like to know, of course, is this mediation effect, is this A times B, is it significant? And the old rules, some of you may know them, the rules by Barron and Kenny, we had a four-step procedure to establish mediation. And basically what they said is first you show that this relationship exists, then you show that this relationship exists, and that this relationship exists, and that once you put this as a predictor in the model, that this relationship either disappears, then you have complete mediation, or that it at least becomes smaller, meaning that you have partial mediation. And if it doesn't change at all, you don't have mediation. That was the idea. If you go to that article is also one of the articles that has been quoted thousands of times in psychological literature. If you now go to the homepage by David Kenny, there's a flat-out statement there that says, I consider this procedure outdated. We don't do it that way anymore. Because what you now would do is you make a structured equation model that has all three of these variables in the model together, simultaneously. And you estimate this and this and that. And now actually we have a way to estimate the significance of the mediation path, and it's a fairly simple formula. The mediation effect is simply this regression coefficient A multiplied by this regression coefficient B, A times B. That's your mediation effect. We need to have the standard error of the mediation effect to be able to do a test. For that, we need the standard error of this regression coefficient, the standard error of A, and the standard error of this regression coefficient, standard error of B. And the formula is very simple, that you have A squared times the standard error squared of B, and B squared times the standard error squared of A. And this was worked out by a guy called Sobel, and it's called the Sobel test. And then you can simply calculate this, and out comes a Z, and you go to the standard normal table and see if that thing is significant. So there is a test that tests the effect, mediation effect, directly, provided you put the whole thing in a structural equation model. There are two programs called M+ and Lavan that actually have this built in. So if you in one of these programs say, okay, I have a mediation effect that is this variable through that variable on that, it will calculate the mediation path and it will calculate the standard error and it will give you a p-value and a confidence interval. And M+ is interesting because it's very powerful, and Lavan is interesting because it's a package in R and that means that it's free. You don't have to pay for it. There are somewhat better methods which are going into much detail because there is a book by McKinnon who explains a lot about mediation, but it's a 400-page book only about mediation. So that's a lot. Cross-cultural comparisons. Well, what do we have? If you have cross-cultural comparisons, so for instance, you have a questionnaire of 5 questions that tries to assess how satisfied you are with your government. And you give that questionnaire to a random sample from people in Finland, the Netherlands, and Spain and England. Just take a few countries. You want to compare how satisfied these people are with their respective governments. One thing, of course, that you need to be sure of is that you're measuring the satisfaction in the same way in all of these countries. It's not so easy because you will have to make translations of your questionnaire. Just not one English question, you have to translate them. When you translate them, you might make errors, but it might also be that some words that look the same have different cultural meaning in different countries. So before you make any comparisons across countries of that kind, you need to establish that you're measuring the same thing in all these countries using your translated measurement instruments. That question is called measurement equivalence. You have to prove that you have measurement equivalence before it makes sense to compare these things across countries. And then we talk about confirmatory factor analysis. And there are 3, let's say, levels of measurement equivalence. The simplest thing is that you have what is called convicural equivalence. So that simply means we have the same factor structure, but loadings might be different, intercepts when we work with means might be different, everything almost might be different, except you have one factor, you have 2 factors in each country and they look more or less the same. That's what you say there. And that is how they check measurement equivalence, say, in the 60s and 70s, because that's what you only thing you could do then. Now we have structured equation modeling and we can impose constraints. And here is where constraints become important. If you can constrain the loadings to be the same and the model still fits nicely, you have what is called metric equivalence. It means you can compare correlations between variables, between countries. Nicer is when you can also constrain intercepts to be the same. That means that actually your factor mean, if you have a calculated factor mean, estimated factor mean for satisfaction with government in these 4 countries, and they turn out to be significantly different, you can validly conclude that yes, in some countries people are more satisfied about their government than in other countries. That is the nice thing that these constraints allow you. And we are now, it's assessed by multi-group SEM. So if you have 4 countries, you do a structured equation model with 4 groups, and you estimate, you test whether you can assume that the loadings and intercepts are the same across these 4 groups. It's a standard procedure in structured equation modeling. And there is some more advanced research going on where people look at the idea if you have partial equivalence, so some loadings are the same, other loadings are not the same, can we still make comparisons? And there are also people who look at approximate equivalence. The idea is that the loadings are not the same, but they're fairly similar. Can we still make valid comparisons? These are new areas of research, actively being researched. Longitudinal data. These are 2 longitudinal models that have been quite popular. The first one, the top one, is popular with the sociologists. It's called the cross-legged panel model. So you have different legs of data, different measurement occasions. In this picture you have 2 of them. And you have several variables, and you have cross-legged. You compare them against each other. So this is reading at measurement point 1. This is reading amount of reading at measurement point 2. This is PC use, being glued to your screen, and this is being glued to your screen at a second measurement occasion. Now we want to know if you are glued to the screen, does that cause you to read less? And if you are a reader, does that mean that you're using the PC less? Which is the direction of the effect. That there is a correlation, you will find the correlation, I assure you. The idea is here that because it's over time, you can have stability. Heavy PC users at time point one are probably still fairly heavy PC users at time point two. But what you want to know is how much of the reading amount in time point two affects the PC user at time point two. Sorry, and here PC use at time point one, how that affects reading at time point two. These cross-legged regression coefficients or paths are what sociologists are interested in because they try to disentangle causal effects here from correlational data, but correlational data that are longitudinal. And you can do that with some rate of success because we know that a causal effect cannot go back in time. Unless you live deep in the Star Trek universe, you can rule that out. So because we have longitudinal data, we can say something about causality here. This is a second model for longitudinal data that has become very popular, which is growth curve. So this is alcohol use year one, alcohol use year two, and alcohol use year three. We have one model that is the intercept, one factor that is the intercept, what is the average alcohol use when we started the study, and we have a slope, and that says how much is alcohol use over time going up or down. And of course, different individuals can differ here. So if you have the hypothesis that, for instance, in adolescent persons, that males have a higher alcohol use and also increase faster over time than females, the thing to do here is to have here an observed variable, a square, which is simply gender, and have arrows going from that variable to the intercept and to the slope. And if these arrows are significant, then you have shown that the trajectory, as it's called, the shape, the curve of alcohol use over all these years is different for boys than it is for girls. You can imagine that people who look at growth or decline, like developmental psychologists, people who look at language development, people who do aging research, where we usually talk about decline, they are very, very much interested in these types of models because you can not only look at average increase or decline, but you can also try to predict that using individual variables. It's a very nice model. Good. Now something different. I'm going to talk about multi-level modeling. And multi-level modeling is a statistical technique that is intended for data that have a hierarchical structure. So you have data that are clusters or groups. Here I have drawn a three-level data structure, so you have groups at different levels and they may have different sizes. And the response, the outcome variable, is usually at the lowest level. And it's nice that groups may have different sizes because these things were developed, for instance, for school research, where we look at pupils within classes, within schools, and we all know that classes and schools don't have the same size. And older analysis methods actually assumed that all these groups had the same size, and that is unlikely to happen in empirical practice, so it's good that this is not assumed here. Now, what makes hierarchical data special? Well, the special thing is that if you have natural groups, like schools and classes, not if you make groups at random. If you pick people from the street and make groups at random, groups don't matter. But if you have naturally occurring groups, like classes and schools and families, people within the same group tend to be more similar than people from different groups. And the reason is, for instance, selection. If you think about schools, schools are in certain neighborhoods, so they draw pupils from similar social, economic, and ethnic backgrounds. But it's also shared history. In classes, they share the teacher, they share the history with each other. And contextual group effects. Groups may have certain characteristics. Schools, for instance, may be public schools or maybe denominational schools. Regions and countries may have different climates, different levels of economic development. And all of that has an effect, of course, on the individuals that are in that context. What it means is that people in the same group are not completely independent. They have some amount of similarity, and standard statistical tests are not at all robust against violation of this specific assumption. In general, when people come to me and they have data that are not slightly not normal, or where they want to do a t-test and the variance in one group is a bit larger than in the other group, I tell them not to worry. But in cases of this lack of independence, they should worry because it has a very, very bad effect on the estimates. Okay, bit of history. No pictures here because you don't have these really, these giants that kind of defined the field. It's more like more cooperative people that influence each other, although there are a number of important people and I will mention them. Well, this kind of started in the 50s, 70s area, period, because at that point people, sociologists for instance, and educational researchers started to become interested in the effects of context on individuals. And they also found out that it's not that easy, and that not that easy is called the ecological fallacy. Because one thing you can do, of course, is do all your analysis at a single level, or all do all your analysis at the highest level. And then you would find things like, if you look at political voting districts, then you find that voting districts that had a lot of immigrants would tend to vote on rightist parties. Now, one conclusion you could draw is that it means that immigrants vote on rightist parties. That's not necessarily true, because you are calculating everything at the group level, at the voting district level, and then you are attaching your conclusion to individuals. And that is basically wrong, because whatever you find at the group level, the real relationship at the individual level could be anything. It could even be that in the data that you have, the immigrants were not even allowed to vote. So the conclusion that it must be the immigrants who vote for the rightist parties is basically nonsense. So that could happen. And that is called the ecological fallacy, or the fallacy of the wrong level. It's okay to aggregate all the data to the district level and do your analysis there, but then you have to make absolutely sure that your interpretation is also only at the district level. If you do an analysis at the higher level and your conclusions are then attached to individuals, that's basically wrong. In the books of that period, you had a lot of analysis tricks. How can we do at least something? And what we also find is no discussion of statistical model. So these are two of the books that were quite popular and influential, especially the left one, the blue one, by Boyd and Everson. You will find a lot of citations to that book. And they discussed multi-level data and how to aggregate and disaggregate and all kinds of analysis stuff. And basically all of that is completely obsolete now. And what you find, the thing that makes it obsolete, is that it's a bunch of tricks. And what you don't find in those books is references in the index to something like random coefficient, which is one of the more important parts of the model now, hierarchical model or statistical model. These things were a bag of tricks, and no statistical model was underlying these tricks. And this is what happened around the 1990s. These are some very influential people at that point. Wijk and Raudenbusch wrote a book called Hierarchical Linear Models and brought out a software. Goldstein, who also wrote a book about multi-level statistical models, again the word model in the title, and a third one, Nicholas Lunkford, who wrote the book Random Coefficient Models, again the word model. This all comes from the statistical world. They worked out models to deal with hierarchical data in a good, statistically sound manner. And this very small blue booklet over there is my contribution to the field, I think 1994 or something like that, 1995. The problem with these books is that they are very statistical. And this book was actually written in English, meaning that I tried to explain how it works without not too many formulas. And here you find the level, you find discussions of estimation methods, how to work with more than two levels, distributional assumptions. This is statistics. It's now no longer a bag of tricks, it's statistics. And all three of these people brought out a program that actually could do the analysis, which is also important, of course. If you're a user, if you're an applied researcher, and you realize that you need a multi-level model, you're probably not in a position that you can write your own program. So what you need is good software that is actually available and that is not too difficult to use. This is the state of affairs by now. What has happened is that it has been extended more or less the same way that structured equation models have been extended to deal with missing data, with nonlinear models, with latent variables. It's made more complicated, but still the same basics. And although the little blue book there is in its completeness on my homepage. I wouldn't download it unless you are interested in a historical description of my work, because this is the latest version, and the chapter 2, where I actually explain what multi-level modeling is freely available on the homepage. And unfortunately, publisher doesn't allow me to have more than one downloadable chapter on the homepage, but I have the manuscript version of some other chapters also on my homepage. So extensions, and what is nice, of course, is that big statistical packages like SPSS, SAS data have picked up on multi-level modeling. These models are now actually available in each of these software packages in a quite accessible format. So unless you want to do something really complicated, you can probably do your multi-level analysis, the thing that you want to do in SPSS or SAS or Stata. Okay, what is actually going wrong when you have a multi-level data set and you do a single-level analysis on that? Well, actually, two things are going wrong. This is one of them. If we have an independent variable at the school level, an independent variable at the pupil level, an outcome variable at the pupil level, we have a prediction error, but we have a second prediction error, which is at the school level. And if you do a simple analysis in SPSS of these data, SPSS will not know that there is a second source of error. So the error that you estimate in SPSS is kind of a combination of the two that you should have been error, and SPSS will not know exactly how much error variance there is in your system. So the standard errors for your regression coefficient will be calculated completely wrong. They will be really very, very far off sometimes. So this is one reason that we need multi-level modeling. We have two sources of error, the second one on the second level. There is one more, which is less obvious. So there we have the one. Here we have the other. When you think about the idea of a pupil variable like pupil sex, the effect of that on the grade, but you have schools or classes, one idea that comes up immediately is, can we assume that the regression coefficient that predicts from pupil sex, the grade that pupil has, that it's the same number in each of these classes? If you're interested in multi-level modeling, that's kind of a weird assumption, because you do multi-level analysis because you think that the context, in this case schools or classes, is important. And if the context is important, it might very well influence the way the process that causes that boys have lower grades than girls in general, of course, that might be different in different schools. That's the whole idea about multi-level modeling, of course, that you want to look at that kind of thing. So that's another reason. Let me go to the equations, and I think this is the last or the next to last equation. Let me take you through it. This is a regression equation where I have one explanatory variable that predicts one outcome variable, with a regression intercept, regression slope, and an error. If you look carefully, you will see that the regression intercept, regression slope, there are two indices there. We have I for individual and J for groups. So if we have regression coefficients, a beta sub 0, J for the intercept, it means we're assuming that different schools have different intercepts. Same thing, beta 1 sub 1 sub J, so beta 1 J. It's assuming that the slope predicting Y from X is not the same in all of these groups. Each group has, in principle, their own slope. So each group has their own regression equation. That's the idea. Now, if that's the case, and you have group-level variables, it makes perfect sense that you would say, okay, let's try to predict these regression coefficients. If groups have different regression coefficients, if we have group-level variables, we can use them to predict the regression coefficient of these groups. And that is what happens here. We are predicting the regression coefficient, the intercept, and the slope, using a regression equation at the second level that involves the school-level variable or the group-level variable Z sub J. The J means it's only varying across schools. There's no I there, so all individuals in the same school have the same number because they're all in the same school, and it's a school variable. Now, you can actually fill in this here, and then you get this equation. It looks complicated, but this part is just a regression equation, and this is the part where you have complicated errors that arise from the fact that we have these measurement, these prediction errors at the second level. We have three errors there. And we have what is called a cross-level interaction, that is the z times x, and that happens because we're trying to predict the slope of x using z. That turns out to be a interaction term. Okay, multi-level regression in a few seconds. What kind of research questions can we answer using multi-level analysis? One of them is very simple. We can look at the effect of a predictor variable at the lowest level, say intelligence, as the predictor of school achievement of individual pupils. So we're looking at a bunch. This is the scatter plot, and this is the regression line. And the thing that is, makes this different from simply doing this in SPSS multiple regression is that we have these two error components. Remember, I showed you that if you want to predict a school variable, you predict something at the individual level. You will also have a school level error. That was the arrow that appeared at the top of that diagram. And here it is in the equation. We have an error component ij, which is individual. Individual I in school j has prediction error a. And in each school, you have a prediction error for that school. It's kind of an average prediction error for the school. So you have two error terms, and that makes this model different from simply doing a multiple regression. But we can also look at the idea that maybe we can explain school differences. So we have an error term here, but maybe it's not total error. It's prediction errors for schools, but maybe if we put in school-level explanatory variables, school size, denomination, things like that. Maybe if you look at classes, you could look at the teaching style of teachers, that type of thing. Can we put that in, and does that diminish the school error? Can we predict some of these residuals from the school, from these variables? So here we're trying to do that. We have mean IQ, so we calculate not only the IQ of the pupils, but also the mean IQ of all the pupils in the same school. And maybe some of the differences between the schools can be explained by the fact that they differ in the average number of smart or not so smart pupils that they have. So that's the idea. You have school level variables, which could be real school variables, like school size, or it could be an aggregation. So we look at the mean IQ or the mean social economic status of the pupils in that school and use it as a school level predictor. That's what we're doing here. So we try to, this is the bunch of regression lines, and here we're looking at the regression lines of two schools, and you can see that one school is constantly a bit higher than the other school. We try to explain that by using variables that are defined at the school level. And we can go further. This is the last idea with having the arrow that was vertical that says, okay, we think about the relationship between a pupil-level explanatory variable, pupil-level predictor, on a pupil-level dependent variable, but these are pupils that are in groups, in schools, and schools matter. So maybe the relationship between the predictor and the dependent variable is different in different schools. And that, of course, is this idea. And if you would write out all the individual school prediction lines, you should see something like this. Clearly you see that these things are not parallel. So in some schools, the relationship between IQ and school achievement here is steeper than it is in other schools. And actually, if you say that, you're saying there is an interaction. And maybe we can predict these regression lines. Maybe we can predict these differences in slopes by having a school-level predictor variable predicting the slopes. And if you work that out, it means that we have to put in an interaction term between IQ and some variable at the school level, which in this case could be mean IQ. If that interaction actually predicts some of the variation in slopes, and you would plot the slopes based upon this more complicated formula, then you would see that they become more parallel, more equivalent. So there are different things that we can predict. We try to predict outcome variables at the pupil level with individual variables or with school variables. And there's an extra thing in multi-level modeling where we have the idea what is called random slopes. You think that slopes of individual predictors and individual outcomes may differ across groups. That's the random idea. They have variation, but not all of that variation, hopefully, is totally random. We hope to be able to predict it with school-level variables involved in an interaction. One thing that became very, very clear, which has made multi-level analysis very, very popular, well, one of them is that you can work with students in classes or individuals within groups, and you actually need multi-level modeling to get good standard errors, meaning to get believable p-values. That message was very strong. But another message was also very strong. You can view repeated data, longitudinal data, you can view that also as a multi-level problem. You can think of them as measurements nested within individuals. Now, why would we want to use multi-level modeling for that if we have repeated measures analysis of variance in SPSS? Well, for a number of reasons. One important reason is that, as I said, multi-level modeling does not assume that we have equal group sizes. So if our groups are persons, and we have measurement occasions within persons, it does not assume that we have the same number of measurement occasions within persons. Now, that's bingo, because that means you suddenly have a very easy way to deal with longitudinal data which are incomplete, where you have dropout of people who are not there on a specific occasion. If you would use SPSS repeated measures analysis of variance for that, you have listwise deletion. Somebody who's dropped out only once in your series of measures is removed from the analysis entirely. That's a waste of information. In multi-level modeling, we don't have the assumption that you have the same number of time points within each individual. Now, this thing was figured out by Steve Rauterbusch in 1986, and it made multi-level modeling enormously popular with people who have longitudinal studies, because you always have dropout. Almost nobody has longitudinal data without dropout, and suddenly there was a very, very easy way to deal with that. You can also have varying occasions. So normally in many studies, panel studies, you would measure people at regular intervals. So you measure people 1 year, second year, third year, maybe you skip the fourth year, and then you measure everybody at the sixth year. So you have a regular succession. But now we also have things like diary data, where you have people that fill in their diary at very different times during the day, and maybe very different times during the week. How do you analyze such data? Well, multi-level models make it easy, because time in such models is just a variable. You can give it any value. Again, if you look at repeated measures analysis of variance, it's very difficult to fit this kind of data structure into repeated measures analysis of variance without having to drop a lot of respondents because they don't fit the structure. So, like growth models and structural equation models, multi-level models for longitudinal data have become very popular if you want to look at development over time and if you want to know what time-changing characteristics and what individual characteristics affect that. So the example that I gave with alcohol use over time, and you want to see whether what the differences are between boys and girls, what you then do is you have longitudinal multi-level data. You have time coded 0, 1, 2, 3 if it's regular, but you could code it 0, 1, 3.5, 8.9 if that's the time points that you have. That's the nice thing. And you would have gender 0, 1, which codes whether boys drink more at the beginning than they do at the end. And you could have the interaction between your time variable and your gender variable, and that would show whether boys increase faster in their alcohol use than girls. So exactly the same research questions could also be asked using multi-level models for longitudinal data. And once people realized that multi-level analysis of repeated data was a very simple way to deal with incomplete data, they were sold. It has become very popular after that. Special model. Sometimes you have models where it's a bit difficult to decide whether one thing is nested on the under the other or the other is nested under the one. Most often it means you have a cross-classification. examples, I have two here. You have pupils who are nested in schools and neighborhoods. Now, it would be nice if pupils in a certain neighborhood will only go to schools in their neighborhood, because then you would have very nicely hierarchical data. But that doesn't happen, of course. Schools draw pupils from neighboring neighborhoods. And in a specific neighborhood, some pupils will go to school to another neighborhood because it's a better school or because their friends go there or whatever. So it's not a nice hierarchical system, and this is called a cross-classification. So there is still nesting. The pupils are nested, but they are not nested nicely within schools, within neighborhoods. They are nested within the cross-classification of schools and neighborhoods. And there are various other examples that you could imagine of that. Now, you don't need to understand this in detail, but this is what the formula would look like for pupils in schools and neighbors. So you have I for pupils, J for schools, K for neighborhoods, and what you see is not a simple subscript IJK, but the J and K are between parentheses. And what this means, this is a notation developed by Harvey Goldstein, which I like a lot, it means we have pupils I nested within the cross classification of J and K. Then here we have a regression coefficient with some student variable. You could have more, of course. You could have regression coefficients connected with variables at the neighborhood, and we have a regression coefficient connected S is schools, N is neighborhoods, P is pupils. So you can have explanatory variables for each of these levels, and you will see that there are three error terms. This is for schools, this is for neighborhoods, and this is for individuals, again nested between within the combination of these schools and neighborhoods. And the setup depends on the software. It can be done, for instance, in MLWin. It's ridiculously difficult. It can be done in SPSS, and surprise, it's ridiculously easy. So you have to look into your own software if you need to do this. But some software really makes it easy to do this kind of thing. Meta-analysis. People have used meta-analysis, where you have outcomes from different studies. You want to combine them. You can view that as a multi-level problem, because you had participants in studies, and you have several studies. If you had the raw data, you could use multi-level analysis. We don't have the raw data, we only have effect sizes, but it turns out we can use multi-level software to combine this stuff. And then you have meta-regression, because you had study-level variables that predict outcomes from different studies. Why use multi-level analysis for that instead of special meta-analysis software? Well, one reason could be that if you have multi-level software and you don't have meta-analysis software, you don't have to buy new software. But it has more flexibility, because meta-analysis software has effect sizes nested within studies, and that's it. It's two levels. A multi-level software now, all of it can analyze at least three levels. So now you could have several outcome variables within studies. Or you could have, for instance, different conditions. So if you have more than one effect size, suppose that you have one control group and two experimental groups, you have two effect sizes in each study. How do you combine them in one analysis? In multi-level software, it's not a problem. And most meta-analysis software cannot deal with that, has not been built for that. If you want to look at some examples, there was a meta-analysis workshop in 2008 in Oxford, and all the materials are online, and they explain this, so you can look at that. By the way, I will make these slides available as a PDF after the festival, and I'm sure that ASCO can find a way to tell you where to find them. Third question. This is a leading question, because you know the answer will be yes, but it will be yes for a specific reason. They don't need to merge. Actually, structured regression modeling and multi-level modeling, although they look quite different, are the same model. And in close connection, there were three articles that showed that. We had an article by Bauer in 2003, who wrote title Estimating Multi-Level Linear Models as Structured Regression Models. How can we do it? Patrick Curran, wrote an article same year, have multi-level models been structurally equation models all along? Of course, his answer was yes. And Mehta and Neil wrote 2 years later an article where they actually gave all the equations and showed in a more analytical way, yes, they are actually the same. The interesting part is that Bauer, Curran, Mehta and Neil are all members of a scientific society called the Society for Multivariate Experimental Psychology in the US. So they have been talking about this model, this type of thing, with each other, and then published these three articles. And the SMEP, as it is called, is a society that was founded by Cattell. Remember Cattell? I mentioned him at the very beginning as one of the founders of factor analysis. So here we have the snake biting its own tail. How are these models the same? I will show it a little bit without going into details because the details are actually quite grisly. Suppose we have a data set here. We have groups and we have two persons in group one and two persons in group two. And these are the variables. This is a Y variable. We have a variable S and a variable Z. S is the sex. So boy, girl, boy, girl. Very neatly stacked in this data set. And this is some kind of explanatory variable. Next thing we do is we make a data set where we actually, each line in the data, each row in the data is a group. So what do we have here? Group 1, this is the score of the first person in the group, comes from that. This is the score of the second person in the group, comes from there. This is the score, this is the gender of the first person of the group on, this is the score on gender for the first person, score on gender of the second person. And here again, second group has the same thing, outcome variable first person, outcome variable second person, gender of the first person, gender of the second person, and so on. And here we have a very neat succession because S.1 is always the male and S.2 is always the female. So you can restructure your multi-level data file into a wide data file where the persons become variables. That is why Mehta and Neil called their article, people are variables too. So here we have people and we make them into variables. And now we write a structured equation model that actually models this multi-level model. And that turns out not to be so difficult here, because here we have an intercept, loadings fixed to 1, that's what they have in common. Here we have the effect of sex. All the time S1 were females, S2 were males, or vice versa. And so we have a loading, one loading to Y1 constrained to be 0, the other one constrained to be 1. So the effect here looks at the difference between male and female. And now we have written a model for a multi-level data as a structured equation model. So here we have the lowest level variation, and here we have the highest level variation. This is the lowest level variation. We put an S here because we want to have to be the same. It's a constraint. The variance of the intercept is the lowest level variance and is the highest level variance for the intercept. And the variance here of the sex slope is actually the variation, the random slope. And we have a covariance. So this very simple data set can turn a multi-level data set into a structured equation modeling data set. We can turn a multi-level model into a structured equation model. So for this case, we have proven that they are the same, because you can turn one model into the other. Now, what if we have different numbers of boys and girls in all these groups? That is simple, because we just reserve space in our wide data set for the maximum number of boys and the maximum number of girls we have ever encountered, and we fill it in, and if we have groups with fewer girls or fewer boys, it's a missing data problem. We can solve that. I've made life easy here because we have all the S1 variables are boy, all the S2 variables are girl, so I can easily make this latent variable, which is the slope of sex. What happens if these are not nice values like 0 and 1? What happens if these are actually scores, different values for different variables? Well, that is where things get really, really ugly, because we would need a loading for each and every value that we encounter as an explanatory variable here in the data set. So you get extremely ugly setups because you have to specify all of these loadings. you have a lot of missing data that take care of the fact that you don't have the same number of people in all of these groups. So it's a very, very ugly structured equation modeling setup. Nobody in their right mind would ever, ever try to do it. Well, actually, for simple data, these guys did it, so they could show in the analysis that you actually got the same results, but only for very, very simple data sets. But you can do it. Meta and Neil proved that you can actually do it for any multi-level data set. So you have just, they have just proven that multi-level analysis and structured equation modeling are the same thing. So, who cares? You can do in a very complicated way in structured equation modeling something that you can do in a very easy way in multi-level software. So why bother? Why is this interesting useful? So I come to the second part of the third section of my talk. Why is this merging of these two technologies actually interesting? What can we do with it? Why? Well, we have a number of interesting implications. One of them is that we have more than 100 years of experience with structured equation modeling. Factor analysis, which is part of structured equation modeling, is more than 100 years old. Path modeling is 95 years old, more or less. And in all these times, people have done a lot of work, theoretical analysis, mathematical statistics, simulations, extensions of models. We have approximately 25, a little bit more years experience with multi-level modeling. People have been doing the same thing, theoretical analysis, simulations, model extensions. Now we show that they are actually the same. The interesting result is that all that we have learned about this actually applies to that. So suddenly all that we have learned about robustness, sample sizes, estimation methods in these 100 years working with structured equation modeling, we can apply that to multi-level modeling. Now, as users, as applied researchers, you couldn't care less, but it means that people who work at multi-level modeling will be able, now we know that's actually the same thing, to bring all these nice stuff that has been developed for structured equation modeling into multi-level modeling quite quickly. Once you know that something can be done, working out how to do it becomes much, much easier. Not for me, I'm not a statistician, but for a real statistician, if you have some idea in which direction you should look for the solutions, they will find it. So I think the combination of multi-level modeling and structural equation modeling will develop quite quickly in the next 10 or 20 years. The other thing is interesting in its for substantive points. So multi-level analysis so far has for 95% been multi-level regression analysis. And now that we know that we have multi-level structural equation modeling, we can bring the nice stuff of structural equation modeling into multi-level analysis. So suddenly we have multi-level mediation models, we have multi-level models that are factor models, we have multi-level models that include measurement models, measurement error. So one thing, if you look at indirect effects, combined predictors and mediators from different levels, what we have here is multi-level mediation. So you might think about what is called the cluster randomized trial. There's a talk about that at the festival I saw. You do an intervention at the group level, but you might think the mediation is that you influence with your intervention some variable at the individual level that subsequently has an effect on the outcome. So we have multi-level mediation that crosses the levels. That's new. We have measurement models at different levels. That's not only nice to be able to correct for measurement errors. It's also great for people who develop instruments to measure things like class climate, work climate, family tightness, cohesion at the group level. Whenever you want to measure a construct at the group level, but you do it by giving a questionnaire to the persons within that group, you are doing a multi-level confirmatory factor analysis. Even if you just sum up. Because if you sum up, you are doing multi-level analysis that assumes a lot of things, like having equal loadings at all these levels. But you can test that. And you could calculate the equivalent of coefficient omega for these group level structures. So if you are interested in measuring group constructs, asking the members of the group what I think about that group, you have a multi-level problem that is now solved. Recent development is that you can actually do almost anything you can do in multi-level regression software now also in multi-level structured equation modeling, including non-normal data, incomplete data, varying slopes. If you have the combination of everything, if you have non-normal data, incomplete data, and you want to have varying slopes, you are still doing something complicated. And if you ask it of the few softwares that can actually do that, you will find out that it's taking a lot of estimation time, calculation time. Even on a modern computer, the very least you need to do is to have a coffee break. But you may have to need a lunch break or go on holiday before you get the results. So it's still a difficult thing. And it's a bit limited. The only programs that can do it is M+, which can do it at only three levels. And you have a program called GLEM, which point is you need Stata because it's a plugin for Stata. It has an unlimited number of levels, and it is very slow. That's the problem with that. Path diagrams have been extended, so you write a path diagram for each level. And this is the within level. This is something developed by Mutain. He simply uses a black dot to indicate here we have a random effect at the second level. So this black dot means that the variable y returns as a variance component at the second level. Here it is. This dot on the regression line means this is a regression line that varies across groups. So it returns at the second level. Here it is. You have to give it a label. Here it returns as a variance, as a latent variable that has a certain amount of variation. And then you can write a structural equation model at that between level, at second level, that could have variables that are only observed at the second level, like school size. But you could also use, and that is different from structural from multi-level regression modeling, you could use this slope variation as a predictor of something else. That is impossible in multi-level regression. I would not know how to do that. In multi-level structured equation modeling, you could do that. So suddenly, if you have a growth model, you have a slope for development over time, say increasing alcohol use, you could use that variation of the slope, you could use that slope to predict something else later, like school dropout. That type of modeling is now possible. I will give a very brief example. This is a multi-level analysis of family data, originally by real data. I later made a simulation out of it. Six intelligence tests. This is the person level. Here I assume two factors. At the family level, where genetic and contextual information becomes together, so the families share not only genetics, but also the context in which they live together. I'm assuming that I'm not looking at twins that have been separated, but at families that really live together. They share a context. So we assume that we have much more similarity at the family level and that one intelligence factor would be enough to model everything at the family level. And that worked, that model fit very well. These are classical structural equation modeling fit measures. If you know them, you will see that it means that the model fits very well. And if you don't know them, I hope that you will believe me when I tell you that the model fits very well. I put in family size as a predictor, just to show that it can be done. In this particular fact, it didn't have an effect, didn't have a significant relationship. What next? I'm nearing the end. What next is I expect that these models, the fact that we now can combine these two things, it will kind of accelerate. More and more people are working with these models. Part of that is due to Bengt Mutain, who wrote his program M+, that can actually estimate a lot of these models. But if you see what the success is of M+, I'm sure there will be competitors who want to take some of his market share. I expect that Bayesian estimation here will be used more. And there's a session on Bayesian estimation I saw, unfortunately, in Finnish, so I won't be attending that one. But I expect using that Bayesian estimation will be used more because Bayesian estimation is very good at estimating complicated models. And these models are complicated. And I expect that we get better diagnostics on how to look at things that go wrong, because the diagnostics that we have now have been developed for single-level models, and they're being applied to at least two-level models, and I would like to have multi-level diagnostics. That's somebody looking for a dissertation here, that's one sure dissertation. And what I like to do, what we need is more information on behavioral estimates with small samples and non-normal distributions. And I also consult with people who have to write for the biomedical kind of health, psychology and health people. If you write in the biomedical field or in applied psychology, very often people, the editors want to have an estimate of effect size. And that is a thing that is not well defined in many multi-level models. And still, you get a reviewer who wants you to give an effect size, which creates a problem for people. And I think that the statistician should work on that as well. These are some helpful references. There are a number of books written by Barbara Byrne, called Structural Equation Modeling in AMOS, Structural Equation Modeling in LISREL, Structural Equation Modeling in M+. You get the message. They're all quite nice. Geisser has written a book about M+. He's a German, and his approach is a bit more structured. Barbara Byrne gives first the example and then tells you what it's good for. And Geisser will first give you the model and then the example. So that's more theory-oriented. For multi-level modeling, there are some handbooks by me and by Snijders and Bosker are the most readable of them all. And on the Center for Multi-Level Modeling, that's the people that bring out MLWIN, they have a huge website with supportive material. And I also tend to put a lot of the things that I do on my website, so you will find it there. I looked through Google to see what I could find about multi-level SEM. There's not much there. A few presentations, and I think half of them are mine. So, and you've got that now. So we're really waiting for somebody to write a small handbook on how to do that. And what I want to make some blatant advertisements. If you're interested in more detail about either multi-level or structural equation modeling, we have a summer school in Utrecht where we give courses on this stuff. There are some other summer schools, but we really concentrate much on multi-level and on structural equation modeling using M+, which also includes some multi-level. So we are limited in a sense, but what we do, we try to give a good course. And there are some things that are interesting about our Department of Methodology and Statistics, I hope for you. We have a research master, as you have, for methodology and statistics in, specifically. And another thing is, in 2014, we are organizing the methodological conference of the European Association of Methodology. And these guys are about three quarters statistics and one quarters methodology. And the methodology includes qualitative methods. So if you would like to come to Utrecht in the summer of 2014, go check out that website. Thank you.
Thank you for a very interesting presentation. Now we have time only a few questions. Please, if you have any questions or comments, there are microphones if you...
Okay, I think my voice can be heard.
Okay.
Well, thanks for the interesting keynote. I'm Jan Pauler from the Game Research Lab. Based on your experiences, what do you think are the most common errors that people make when they are starting using SCM?
Well, as I said, it depends a little bit on the software, because some software will actually prevent you from making some of these errors. I think that what I see people do when they use AMOS, where the input is graphical, and AMOS will allow you to do anything, is that they make models with errors going all over the place, which from a substantive view or from a statistical view make no sense. So people very enthusiastically look at modification indices, which show if you put an arrow here, it will improve the fit of your model enormously, and then they put it there without realizing what it does to your model. So there's something that you should not change in your model, because then you change something very important for your substantive theory. You should not change that unless you're really sure that it's the best way to do. And I might add the error in a sense that people make with M+. M+ can do a lot of things. So people try to do a lot of things. They have a very big model, it's multi-level, it's categorical, they have missing data, maybe they want to have something longitudinal in there. it's still life. I mean, if you make things too complicated, and especially if you have a small sample, at some point your estimation will break down. And you don't always notice that. I have seen situations where M+ told you that there was convergence. If you look very careful, you see that it estimates negative variances and other things that cannot be. But if you overlook that fact, you might actually think that your results are worth something. So in programs in that really complicated software and complicated models like M+, I would be very suspicious of the results. I would go with a magnifying glass over the output to make sure that it's doing what I want and that the estimates are reasonable.
Okay, more questions, comments?
Thank you. Jani Erola from the University of Turku. The structural equation models are certainly coming more popular again, and I guess the part of the reason is that, like you showed, that it's been shown that it's related to multi-level modeling as well. But the other reason for that is the work done by Judah Pearl especially. And I think what kind of differentiates his point of view from what you actually said, that they are Pearl and his followers, especially Morgan and Winship, they are relaxing the kind of, or at least saying that we should be able to say more about the causality as well when we are using this stuff. So what's your take on that?
Oh, I completely agree with you. Only it's what I alluded to in the beginning, that the Wikipedia kind of said structural equation modeling is a way to deal with causality. I think it's not. I think the way Julia Pearl, and there's a book by Winship now out, and a colleague, I forgot his name, but it's both two author volume, who talk about causality, how to think about that in a principled way, and after that one of the tools to assess causality could be structural equation modeling, but it could also be something else. But that's an entirely, that's a different field. I mean, that would be another talk of 1.5 hours at least, and I'm not really the best person to give that talk. But I agree with you completely. If you want to think about causality, there are now some principled procedures to do that, and they have been described in books. And I find these books quite difficult, but they are there, and you can study them. And structural equation modeling is then just one of the tools to do this. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you again.